Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this year's Tanner Lecture. I'm Martin Harris, the new, very new president of Clare Hall, and it's a particular pleasure on behalf of the college to welcome you all here this evening. Just a few words of introduction, if I may, about the Tanner Lectures themselves before I talk about this evening's speaker. The Tanner Lectures were established by an American scholar, industrialist, and philanthropist, Obert Clark Tanner, in 1978. The purpose of the Tanner Lectures, as he saw them, was to advance and reflect upon scholarly and scientific learning related to human values. In creating these lectureships, Professor Tanner said, "I hope these lectures will contribute to the intellectual and moral life of mankind. I see them simply as a search for a better understanding of human behavior and human values. This understanding may be pursued for its own intrinsic worth, but it may also eventually have practical consequences for the quality of personal and social life." Obert Tanner was a member of the Faculty of Philosophy at the University of Utah from 1946 till his death in 1993. He was also a professor of religion at Stanford University. And all at the same time, from 1927 onwards, he began to build up a business manufacturing, a jeweler's business specializing in corporate recognition awards, not least for universities themselves. And his company became the largest firm of its kind in America and serves as the financial underpinning for the Tanner Philanthropies, which funds this lecture series. As you'll probably know, the series moves between the University of California, Harvard, Michigan, Princeton, Stanford, Utah, Yale, and British partners are Brasenose College, Oxford, and of course, Clare Hall, where it forms one of the highlights of the college's intellectual calendar. The lectures may be in any fields, philosophy, religion, the humanities, the sciences, creative arts, learned professions, or from leadership in public or private affairs. The lectureships are international and intercultural and transcend ethnic, national, religious, and ideological distinctions. An appointment as a Tanner Lecturer is a recognition of uncommon achievement and outstanding abilities in the field of human values. So in this context, in one sense, our Tanner Lecturer this year, Professor Lisa Jardine, needs no introduction from me because she so clearly meets that description. And yet there is so much to say about Lisa. First and foremost, of course, she is an amazingly talented scholar. Professor of Renaissance Studies and Director of the Centre for Editing Lives and Letters at Queen Mary University of London. She specialised in early modern British history with an extraordinary range of publications. Most recently, she's focused in particular on the political, intellectual, cultural and scientific links between the United Kingdom and Holland, between Britain and Holland, a truly fascinating, intertwining story. Lisa also plays a number of very distinguished roles in British public life. Trustee of the V&A, patron of the National Council on Archives, key roles in the Royal Institution and the Royal Society. And most recently, and perhaps best known to many of you, the chair of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, HFEA, which is right at the centre of so many issues, complex issues, where scientific change and social patterns and social attitudes intersect. A prolific author of books and articles at the highest level, and a truly fascinating broadcaster. I can't be the only person in this room who's woken up on a Sunday morning and felt moved to shout, yes, yes, as Lisa's talked on her point of view at a time when normally one would be quite soporific. And that's a truly stimulating experience too. And it's a particular pleasure for me to introduce Lisa this evening because we were exact contemporaries here in Cambridge and shared our political enthusiasms in the University Labour Club. And we met again very recently at the Hay Festival, where her lecture led me to acquire and read her latest major work, Going Dutch, How England Plundered Holland's Glory, which I found quite fascinating from beginning to end. And now here she is this evening as the Tanner Lecturer at Clare Hall, the college's first major intellectual happening of my presidency, and it gives me very great personal pleasure to introduce to you this evening Professor Lisa Jardine. Lisa.
I'm probably going to stand over here because I'm not tall enough to look over the lectern, not even in my killer heels. Let me start by saying a couple of words of introduction. The first is, of course, to say how honoured I am to be asked to give these lectures. The second is to say how unbelievably scared I am, because this is actually a very interesting gathering. Probably many of you don't know how interesting it looks from the front here. Martin and I were contemporaries at Cambridge and pillars of the Cambridge Labour Club. There are quite a lot of other pillars of the Cambridge Labour Club here who I haven't seen for a very long time. And then there are large numbers of, I'm looking at some, fellow strugglers in Cambridge through many years of wonderful political life. You know, I'm not allowed to have a political life anymore. Any press here, go away. Because, of course, I'm no party for the HFEA. But I have to say here this evening that, you know, I come to this evening as with these memories. The memories are all around me in the audience, and that's a very scary thing to engage with work which is quite a nostalgic trip for me to begin with, through everything that formed and framed me in those years, and that's, I know, is why many of the people here are here. Everything that framed and made me has been fed back into these lectures, and I was, I have to tell you, really shaken by how many of the things I say and write that I believe are my own came out of that left and Raymond Williams. It's an extraordinary thing that happens to you when you discover, going back in this way, that phrases that you use on a regular basis that you truly think you invented yourself, or at least took over from some broad sort of culture, come directly, verbatim, out of what you were reading when you were 19, right? It's a sobering moment in one's life, and I'm at it. And therefore, the final bit of nostalgia I need to explain to you to prepare for the lectures is I took my main title, What's Left of Culture and Society, with huge nostalgia, from a book that Julius Windels and I wrote in 1989, just after another ghastly catastrophe of Tory revival. She's in the second row. She would be right in the middle of the second row, she's going to be, so I'm going to stand right over here. But it was a signal, really, that I was not only revisiting Raymond Williams, but revisiting some very important moments in my own life. And you can still buy What's Left on ABE Books for a penny. Right. The title of the first lecture, both lectures have titles, I'm not sure if you've had them. What's Left of Culture and Society is the overarching title. The first lecture is called The Process of Communication is the Process of Community. And the second is called Communication is a Whole Social Process. And both of those are quotations from one paragraph of Williams's, which I will come back to in the second lecture. But I start with a quotation by Raymond Williams from Culture and Society, 1958, 50 years ago this year. A culture, while it is being lived, is always in part unknown, in part unrealized. The making of a community is always an exploration, for consciousness cannot precede creation, and there is no formulation for unknown experience. A good community, a living culture, will, because of this, not only make room for, but actively encourage all and any who can contribute to the advance in consciousness, which is the common need. Wherever we have started from, we need to listen to others who started from a different position. Shortly after I'd been invited to deliver these lectures, a distinguished scientist of my close acquaintance stopped me at the graduation ceremony at Queen Mary to ask me a question. How could one any longer advance an argument to justify funding research in the humanities. Since the urbane and broad-minded scientist in question had always shown a healthy respect for humanities disciplines as a whole, it was in fact my principle, I confess I was taken aback and caught genuinely off guard by his question. I was even more dismayed to discover as we talked that I no longer felt I could, with any confidence, provide him with a robust off-the-cuff answer. But what my colleague's question did do was return me to an old train of thought, nurtured by my long-standing admiration for the socialist intellectual and literary critic Raymond Williams, which used, I believed, to allow me to answer my colleague's question confidently. And it prompted me to join it up to a more recent, equally pressing question I had already begun asking myself. What has been the effect on our understanding of what it means to participate in the culture of an advanced liberal democracy, of the rapid expansion of new media and the internet? So the two lectures which follow have developed out of my efforts over recent months to bring these two questions together. In the first, I re-examine Raymond Williams's account of the significant interconnectedness of a particular idea of a common culture with a politically aspirational, socialist, or perhaps radical version of a living community or an open democratic society. In the second, I try to extend the reach and purchase of that account to engage with some of the, for many of us, pressing issues raised by the rapid and seemingly uncontrolled expansion of mass media, popular culture, and the internet today. I might as well tell you in advance that, entirely consistently with my own lifelong sense of optimism about the society in which we live, I believe that I've arrived at a satisfactory answer to my colleague's skepticism as to whether research in the humanities counts for anything is indeed relevant to anybody today. I am, of course, intensely curious to see whether I will have convinced my panel of distinguished expert respondents likewise. And I should just say, to stop you getting nervous, that the first lecture is slightly longer than the second one. So I've agreed with Martin Harris that we might take the gap slightly. So don't get worried you're going to be here all night. It's just that laying down the Raymond Williams argument takes slightly longer than telling you everything I know about the internet. In an interview in 1968, reflecting on the intellectual and political impact of his seminal book, Culture and Society, Raymond Williams explained why the idea of culture was of such vital importance to him personally. Culture, he said, was the way in which the process of education, the experience of literature, and for someone moving out of a working class family to higher education, inequality came through. What other people in different situations might experience more directly as economic or political inequality was naturally experienced from my own root as primarily an inequality of culture, an inequality which was also, in an obvious sense, an uncommunity. This is, I think, the most important way to follow the argument about culture. In order to make apparent the full emotional weight of this statement of Williams's own sense of recognizing himself in a particular way through his engagement with culture, specifically, in his case, in the form of canonical literary and not-so-canonical literary texts, it's helpful to set alongside it another from his second similarly influential book, The Long Revolution, which came out in 1961. There, Williams makes it clear how animate, not to say dynamic for him, is the relationship between the individual and art. We cannot say that art is a substitute for other kinds of communication, since when successful, it evidently communicates experience which is not apparently communicable in other ways. We must see art, rather, as an extension of our capacity for organization, a vital faculty which allows particular areas of reality to be described and communicated. To succeed in art is to convey an experience to others in such a form that the experience is actively recreated, not contemplated, not examined, not passively received, but by response to the means, actually lived through by those to whom it is offered. For Raymond Williams, it is the individual's lived-through response to art and culture that provides his or her vital connection to the community from which they come. In conversation with his contemporary Richard Hoggart in 1960, Williams gave a more specific account of his personal journey from uncommunity to community, a fully realized personal sense of belonging. And this will be more vivid for those of you who are trained in the humanities, because it makes more concrete the terms of that earlier observation. Here is how he remembers himself responding to perceived inequality of access when he arrived as a scholarship boy at Cambridge. It seemed to me I had to try to go back over the Arnoldian literary tradition, to look at it again and get it into relation with my own experience, to see the way the intellectual tradition stood in the pattern of my own growing up. As I saw the cultural tradition then, it was mainly Coleridge, Arnold, Leavis, and the Marxists, and the development really was a discovery of relationships inside the tradition, and also a discovery of other relationships, Cobbett and Morris, for example, who brought in parts of my experience that had been separate before. Getting the tradition right was getting myself right, and that meant changing both myself and the usual version of the tradition. I think this is one of the problems we are both conscious of. Remember, he's talking to Hoggart. I think this is one of the problems we're both conscious of, moving out of a working class home into an academic curriculum, absorbing it first, and then trying to get the two experiences into relation. Getting the tradition right was getting myself right, and that meant changing both myself and the usual version of the tradition. For Raymond Williams, it is in encountering and engaging with available culture that each individual will recognize his or her more or less belonging in terms of inclusiveness or a sense of being part of a communal project. In spite of the poignancy, and it's very poignant to me, it's a passage I've used many times before, of that first passage I read you, I find it enduringly encouraging. Williams was absolutely confident that culture was the active bonding, the glue, which held a community or a society together, giving its members a sense of personal participation and an understanding of a shared social project. That was why, in the 1960s, under his towering influence, so many of us turned from the sciences to the humanities as part of a perceived urgent search for deeper understanding of the social and political structure of the society in which we lived. For those of you who don't know my CV, I came up to read maths, I read maths for 2 years, and under the direct influence of Raymond Williams, changed to English in my third year. I've begun my train of thought for these Tanner lectures nostalgically with a remark made by Raymond Williams in an interview that took place 10 years after the publication of his Culture and Society, 1780 to 1950, the book which, for many of us growing up, growing to intellectual maturity in those years, defined a radical new approach to the societies, one which promised to place an understanding of culture at the heart of the radical political agenda. That's why I was so taken aback, as it were, 40-something years later, to find myself in a discussion about that and not be confident at that moment, not be as confident as I had been, that obviously culture was where you encountered inequality and built community. Already, I have to confess that in that first quote, I won't go back to it because otherwise I really will overrun, I truncated Williams's comment. So I will just say that that was the quote which started culture was the way in which the process of education, the experience of literature, and for someone moving out of a working class family to higher education, inequality came through. I've carried that with me in my heart ever since that then. But I truncated it, and I was actually taken aback when I got back to the paragraph, because it goes on with a more dated sentence, and I want to put it in honorably so that we know that we are talking about something that was written 50 years ago. He went on, "This is, I think, still the most important way to follow the argument about culture, because everywhere, but very specifically in England, culture is one way in which class, the fact of major divisions between men, shows itself." So before I've even got going, I have to acknowledge that in its explicit preoccupation with England and with class and its concentration on men, not humankind, culture and society belongs very specifically to its late 50s moment. I don't think it undermines it, but I think to be honourable I have to make that clear, because actually at the time we got quite exercised about those things. And in What's Left, the book that Julia and I wrote, we got very exercised about it. Now I discover that I'm so totally formed by it, it almost seems like throwing the chalk at the teacher for all the impact it probably made. Nevertheless, within limitations, what I set out to explore in this first lecture is the extent to which the terms of Williams's analysis of culture in relation to his contemporary society can be adapted usefully to gain understanding of the comparable situation, predicament perhaps, in which we find ourselves 50 years later in the first decade of the 21st century. I should also admit that in my exploration, I don't in fact confine myself to culture and society, but do take in The Long Revolution, published, as I say, 3 years later in 1961. In justification, I would argue that the key themes in Williams's first groundbreaking book, particularly those maintaining a tight relationship between forms of culture and forms of social organization, were quite deeply buried in that first book and surfaced more clearly in the second. It was also in The Long Revolution, which Juliet Mitchell, I have to, in the front second row, responded to with her Women, The Longest Revolution, another book that was very, article that was very formative for me. It was also in The Long Revolution that it became obvious that Williams's project was not simply to account theoretically for the relationship between culture and society, but to use the theoretical account as a political lever to produce a radical manifesto for culture-led social change. Whereas culture and society had been greeted by the intellectual community in Britain with admiration, The Long Revolution was attacked at the time of its publication from both the left and the right. As Williams later remembered it, the degree of hostility was quite unforgettable. And I have to digress again, because I'm a terrible digressor, to say that when I arrived at Jesus College as the first woman fellow and went into whatever it was called, the junior parlor or the something or other, and Raymond was sitting there reading the newspaper, and I can't remember, I'd had a terrible review of my book, my first book. And Raymond said that to me again. He said, you know, "Oh, you ain't seen nothing." He wouldn't talk like that. He said, "Oh, whoa, you know, one bad review, you should have seen what happened to me with The Long Revolution." As he remembered it, the degree of hostility was quite unforgettable. And what he then reminded me was, if you are going to effect social change, people have to get a bit cross. By this time, Williams had been appointed to the English faculty at Cambridge, from where he exerted an extraordinary intellectual influence over left-leaning students. A fundamental mistrust, however, coloured his relations with the university, as I well remember. And Raymond died suddenly and unexpectedly in 1988 at the age of 65, shortly before I myself left Cambridge for the University of London. What interests me this evening is how convincingly, in engaging as he did in his years at Cambridge, largely with literary texts in quite a broad sense, Williams gives an increasingly clearly formulated and persuasive account of the way shared experience is actively lived through in culture, such that it can be used to explore and articulate our relationship with key social and political structures in order to develop an inclusive, democratic political agenda for the future. So in moving from that sense of inequality into the exploration of culture and where he could find himself and model himself in reaction to or in collaboration with that place, and therefore forming, as he understood it, a community, a shared community of those who had made that journey. I'm going to be saying that Williams was making, was the trajectory of Williams's intellectual progress and alongside his political activism is a model that I think we can use today. And that's what I'm mostly going to do in the second lecture. So let me try and get that a bit clearer. If Williams is right, and art and culture are where each and every one of us connects emotionally with each and every one of those around us in order to engage in an unspecified shared social project, then it continues to be important to give a sustained analysis of contemporary culture today. It ought to offer us clues as to precisely how such bonds are formed and of what kind they are or might become, allowing us to go on recognizing them as such in an increasingly unfamiliar, virtually unrecognizable, or indeed unrecognizably virtual, contemporary cultural landscape. Williams's own project in relation to culture is clear and explicit in his early writings. Enshrined in the creative arts and associated social interactions are to be found the shared structures of feeling that hold individuals in all their diversity together in a community. These are the common but mostly unacknowledged patterns of belief on the basis of which the members of a community together consent to the formal structural constraints imposed by the economic and political institutions under which they live. And I quote him again, "We are seeking to define and consider one central principle, that of the essential relation, the true interaction between patterns learned and created in the mind and patterns communicated and made active in relationships, conventions, and institutions. Culture is our name for this process and its results. The more we understand about how the individual engages with culture and finds his or her place within it, according to Williams, the better we will understand how change takes place in the social and political structures that bind individuals together by its means. Individual engagement with culture is an active process. The work of art or culture places before its audience an object for scrutiny, which invites them to take it on board emotionally and respond. The creative act of any artist is the process of making a meaning active by communicating an organized experience to others." That's from that quote that I used a little bit back. "It's what he identified as the active, engaged character of this process, which allows Williams confidently to turn to art and culture as the place where social change is articulated and engaged with by those less inclined to alter the status quo. It is, he contends, through close examination of works of art, for him especially works of literature, that we can come to understand the way in which institutional reorganization, for him, industrialization, modifies, quote, the patterns learned and created in the mind, thereby permanently altering society. I quote him again, "The history of the idea of culture is a record of our reactions in thought and feeling to the changed conditions of our common life." In fact, what Williams does is robustly to answer my scientific colleague's question about the continuing relevance or otherwise of close academic study in the humanities. To see art as a particular process in the general human process of creative discovery and communication, he says, is at once a redefinition of the status of art and the finding of means to link it with our ordinary social life. Williams is talking here, as he always is, about creativity in the arts, by which he means most specifically literature, while including drama, film and TV, and occasionally painting and sculpture. But because his definition of culture ultimately extends to all creative responses to and manipulations of processes and structures of organisation produced within any given society, there is no reason why we should not nowadays include general or popular communication in the sciences and technology. That, at any rate, is what I propose. Since Williams published Culture and Society, a considerable amount has been written about the fundamentally social nature of scientific investigation, the way in which exchange amongst scientists, qua members of a defined community, defines topics for exploration, questions to be addressed, and the ways answers to them are framed and executed. And I think that work that has happened since Williams's time, had it happened before, would have allowed Williams to have included science and general science writing and technology within his frame of reference. I shall particularly want this extended understanding of what culture includes in my second lecture. It is, in my view, the clearer understanding today that in spite of its perhaps greater claims for objectivity, science is subject to the same social formation as other forms of human interaction and communication that lends additional force to Raymond Williams's original insights, allowing us, I would argue, to extend them to account for today's much altered cultural milieu. There are secondary strands of Williams's thinking in Culture and Society which I suggest also continue to resonate today. One of these is his careful resistance to designating any part of cultural production as mass culture, with an accompanying sense of dumbing down or dilution. He absolutely refuses that, and I have to say, in this dreary week, I won't even speak their names from a public platform, this dreary week of even The Guardian covering crap radio. Right. But the masses is us. This is what Raymond is just going to tell us. His careful resistance to designating any part of cultural production as mass culture, with a sense of dumbing down, as being over and against us. And here he is. The masses are always the others, whom we don't know and can't know. Yet now, in our kind of society, we see these others regularly in their myriad variations, stand physically beside them. They are here, and we are here with them. And that we are with them is, of course, the whole point. To other people, we are the masses. Masses are other people. In what I consider a helpful reminder, Williams suggests that it's the use of the word mass which allows us to persuade ourselves that universal suffrage and widened access to education have debased cultural standards as opposed to broadening, deepening, or altering them. And here he is. I just can't resist these. I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. There are, in fact, no masses. There are only ways of seeing people as masses. In an urban industrial society, there are many opportunities for such ways of seeing. The point is not to reiterate the objective conditions, but to consider personally and collectively what these have done to our thinking. The fact is surely that a way of seeing other people, which has become characteristic of our kind of society, has been capitalized for the purposes of cultural and political exploitation. What we see neutrally is other people. I think that probably must be. Yes, many others, people unknown to us. In practice, we mass them and interpret them according to some convenient formula. To the degree that we find the formula inadequate for ourselves, we might wish to extend to others the courtesy of acknowledging the unknown. We may want to hold on to this idea when we come to consider mass communications as they've developed at the beginning of the 21st century, and to heed Williams's warning not to assume that wider public access to communications will inevitably lead, at least in the longer run, to a lower quality of cultural output, to a debased idea of what most people share or believe culturally. And finally, in Culture and Society, a key component for Williams in any development of the conditions for social and political change, which is culture-led, is wider and broader access to education, which many people here know is extremely deep, close to my heart. It is a liberal education which provides the terms in which the culture all around us is understood, and it is the uneven reach of and access to that education which determines the way in which those from different social backgrounds engage with it. At its worst, absence of education is a precondition for a settled sense of social exclusion. And as Raymond put it, it is clear that the highest standards of literacy in contemporary society depend on a level of instruction and training far above that which is commonly available. For this reason, it is still much too easy to conclude that a majority culture is necessarily low in taste. It is obvious we've allowed technical changes to get far ahead of educational changes. At the time when Williams was writing, in the late 1950s, the responsibility for training for literacy in its full sense, which is what he is asking for there, was still divided in the state sector between grammar and secondary modern schools, and the school leaving age was 15. He himself was directly involved with adult education, the education of what we today call returners through the WEA. It was, he believed, only by introducing those traditionally excluded from full literacy to a humane education that it would eventually become possible to transform and democratize British society. And I have a piece here that I think I might skip, which just points out, and at least one person in the audience will have wanted to draw it to my attention, that, of course, F.R. Leavis, who he named, remember, in that list, his Arnoldian list, also laid great stress on education, although his intellectual inspirations or aspirations were by no means socially radical, but in a very interesting way, looking back now from that distance, in the sphere of education, they have eerily for me, because I would be one of those who would have said at the time, nothing in common, but there is a kind of congruence. Writing at a time when the British education system was still deeply socially fractured, Williams argued consistently for a single integrated system. In the manifesto Britain in the 1960s, with which the second book, The Long Revolution, ends, which is totally wonderful. If you don't read anything else, read the Britain in the 1960s at the end of The Long Revolution. His insistence on the place of an education system accessible to all is categorical. My own case about social change is that the interdependence of elements, which I described as a matter of theory, is an argument for conceiving change on the widest possible front. The changes in emphasis in our economy, in our ordinary working relationships, in our democratic institutions, and in education are all relevant to cultural change in this more explicit field. I would repeat my emphasis on the overriding educational problem, the provision of new kinds of education for the now neglected majority between 15 and 21. The growth of adult education is also relevant. According to Williams, vocational education, or education designed by a particular regime to inculcate its dogma, fails absolutely to provide that inclusivity, the possibility of responding and reshaping learned experience to one's own purposes, which is required for genuine social cohesion. The more any administration attempts to implement its own political agenda in its educational offering, the less adequate such an education is as part of a community strategy of belonging. At the same time, Williams believes that even limited engagement with the literary and artistic traditions of a community provides each individual with the tools for creative and thus inclusive thinking as a member of it. Williams's model of education is what is today labelled, borrowing a term from a discussion of internet culture, which I will move on to in my second lecture, as generative. And I will explain more about that. Not locked down to specific usages, but open to be developed and incorporated in a wider picture envisaged by the learner in his or her community. And I'd love you to hold those two, that opposition. Generative, which is pretty easy, which is about how what you have learned can be reapplied and modified and creatively expanded, moved elsewhere, locked down, which unfortunately we now know about mostly from shootings in American high schools, when everybody is confined to their building and people with guns patrol, is supposed to capture, and I think what you will see in the second lecture does capture, a kind of knowledge which is transferred to from a kind of transfer which does not allow, which specifically does not allow reuse in other forms. And the 68 struggles in Paris of the students was by students who were in vocational channels from which they felt they couldn't diverge. So that's lockdown in this terminology. As part of an agenda for change, Williams comes down firmly on the side of an educational program which acknowledges its responsibilities in giving each individual access to a culture which sustains their inclusion within the wider community. And he says, it is a question of whether we can grasp the real nature of our society or whether we persist in social and educational patterns based on a limited ruling class, we'd probably say educated elite, a middle professional class, a large operative class, cemented by forces that cannot be challenged and will not be changed. And that's the lockdown. The privileges and barriers of any inherited kind will in any case go down. It is only a question of whether we replace them with the free play of the market, or by a public education. Doesn't that sound quaint now? Free play of the market. As of the last few weeks, we don't believe in that anymore, do we? And of course he didn't. He's saying we shouldn't believe in it. Or by a public education designed to express and create the values of an educated democracy and a common culture. In spite of the inevitably dated quality of some of his articulations of key points, but not so dated, here are the Williams-derived theoretical principles I'm suggesting might still form useful components of an examination of the relationship between culture and society today. Crucially, the idea that culture plays an active part in the complex of influences which form us all emotionally and define us as participating members of our community, be that a global one or a nation state, brings the humanities back into the bigger picture as intrinsic to social and political understanding. In my own capacity as a professor of humanities, rereading Williams reminds me that what I profess is a belief in the active, shaping influence of culture upon all aspects of our everyday lives. So now, to draw this first Tanner lecture to a close, I want to take a step away from culture and society, lighten up a bit actually, and offer you some preliminary observations of my own, taking as my starting point that key idea of Williams's of the formative effect of culture on society, of the fact that culture is, quote, not passively received but actually lived through by those to whom it is offered. If culture at all levels and of all types is a web of meaning engaging each of us directly and actively forming our emotional understanding of our relationship to society, then it needs to be given serious consideration alongside other such shaping influences, economic, political, and social, as part of any assessment of who we think we are. This means that any analysis of social structure ought to take account of the evidence and involvement offered by cultural sources contributing to an understanding of strategies for social cohesion in general. The skills for such consideration are the powerful array of tools developed within the disciplines of text studies and history, including history of ideas, textual analysis, close reading, linguistics, narratology, psychoanalysis. These are deployed tellingly across research in the humanities, and their outcomes feed into that clarity of understanding of the culture-determined social fabric that I am interested in. We have made a good deal of progress in the areas identified as key by Williams and as important for culture-led social change. in the 50 years since Culture and Society, that great tradition in art and literature has been replaced by a broader, distinctly more open version of actively formative cultural influences. In no small part, this is a consequence of widened access to education, which has extended the boundaries of relevance in art and literature. How does that vital process of drawing the individual into the community through culture take place in practice now? Let me give you a single example from the plastic arts, an area into which William never, as far as I am aware, actually strayed, and the work of the sculptor Anthony Gormley. I choose Gormley because I think we can agree that his canonical artistic work has general accessibility and successfully straddles any putative high-low divide. If the only thing you know is the Angel of the North, you certainly know the Angel of the North. So just to say where I'm starting from, I'm starting with Gormley because Gormley has total acceptance as high art, but extraordinary currency as with a broader community. Gormley's own reflections upon the way he expects his audience to engage with the arrays of life-sized cast iron figures he creates based around his own body, interestingly, recapitulate some of the terms we've already met. I didn't ask him, but I bet he read Raymond Williams. In Gormley's view, in any encounter with a Gormley artwork, he anticipates, expects, and asks for a strongly experienced sense of emotional kinship and collective involvement on the part of his audience. And he writes, "The body is the collective subjective and the only means to convey common human experience in a commonly understood way." Gormley's art sets out to trigger connection between community and artwork by site-specific location and juxtaposition. It's a direct prompt for the onlooker, a request for an answering engagement and active responding recognition. One of his recent installations in London, Event Horizon, in summer 2007. You may not know the title, but if you were in London in that period, you will probably have seen a bit of it, featured a set of 31 life-sized human figures on the tops of key buildings around the Hayward Gallery, where he had an exhibition. Simply noticing the figures in the course of one's ordinary movement around the city meant becoming aware in an unfamiliar way of the scale of buildings and skyline and using our eyes to test the relation of the human body to its built environment. Every one of Gormley's figures is based on his own, is a body cast of his own body. When you looked up from the Hayward Gallery at the buildings around, the Channel 4 building, various buildings, what was shocking was suddenly to be given depth of perspective in that familiar skyline, because some of the Gormleys were tiny and some of them were big, whereas when we look at buildings in a city, they all sort of look the same. The skyline all looks the same size. Architects here would cringe. But they look the same size to me. So just noting them arrested you and made you look again. And closer scrutiny from Waterloo Bridge, say, on which a single lonely standing figure was positioned on the pavement, produced a troubling sense of individual insignificance and helplessness within the cityscape, which T.S. Eliot would have probably recognized on Waterloo Bridge. A key moment in Gormley's artistic production came around 1990, when he took the aspiration to encourage his audience to make connections between his art and themselves one stage further by actively involving the local community in its production. Field, which has been produced in a number of forms between 1989 and 93, has become probably the most widely known of such installations after The Angel of the North. Site-specific in each of its successive versions, it involves the participation of a whole community in as unskilled artists' assistants, and he's done this all over the world. The material of art handed over to the audience to contribute to the shaping and formation of the artwork themselves. Each member of that community models a quota of pint-sized figures from clay. They're little sort of human figures with two indented eyes. And tens of thousands of locally fired terracotta figures are then arranged by Gormley to fill a carefully chosen gallery space, ideally so overwhelming it that they flood out of sight beyond the enclosure, so you can never achieve a vantage point from which to see them all. Field deliberately reverses the process whereby the work of art is the objects of the onlooker's attentive gaze and thereby unsettles them. In any collection of visitors specific to a gallery in which Field is installed, it's a reasonable assumption that a number who have come to view it have taken part in it themselves. So there will be not just those looking at the installation, but those who are looking at where their figures are. And furthermore, as Gormley knows, everyone will recognize their own figures, even though they are formed supposedly uniformly. If any of you went to see the First Emperor exhibition and saw how diverse the figures were of the Chinese terracotta figures, it's a wonderful thing that two pairs of human hands will ever shape the identical shape. So in any collection of visitors, it was a reasonable assumption that a number had come to view the part they themselves had played in making the work, and the force field that they made drew other onlookers in, producing the experience that the boundary between local life world and art world has collapsed. Viewers experience themselves as the object of myriad gazes directed towards them, prompting questions about the limits of our individuality and the nature of group identity. The emotional kinship and collective involvement Gormley requires of us in each of his installations revives and then goes beyond an age-old, urgently felt need to locate our individual emotional understanding outside and beyond ourselves in a shared community of observers. For Gormley, our very identity is bound up in our capacity simultaneously to share and shape with others recognizably like ourselves, a life world, to use Jürgen Habermas's evocative term, which is permanently open and unbounded. Now, as I stumbled there, that was because I can hear my critic's voice coming through. Any example I take, I will shape it, won't I? What it means, what our response should be. So I'm conscious that that critic's voice inevitably intrudes here, already translating Anthony Gormley's work into the terms of my own argument. And I have to say that when I was looking for examples, that happened to me over and over again. This was the final one I left in. It's very interesting how every example that you give in your own voice molds the cultural artifact or event to the terms of the argument that you're giving. So I'm helpless to know what to do about that. That was, I felt Gormley was the most useful one for me to use. That absolute recognizability of his Angel of the North stands here for me for the shift in our train of thought from 1960 to 1990 and the kind of habit of cultural sharing that had developed over that 30 years as I draw this first lecture towards a conclusion. In 50 years, much of what Raymond Williams was talking about in terms of educational opportunity and inclusive classroom strategies for overcoming an immediate sense of uncommunity inequality on the part of those from less privileged backgrounds encountering culture has been achieved. As Williams predicted, some of this has been affected by means of the mass media. F.R. Leavis and other more conservative cultural theorists of the 1950s and 60s deplored. The less widely read, less inclined to read, have been made familiar with the great tradition through high-quality TV and film dramatizations of classic fiction, bringing new groups of people to, for example, the 19th-century novels of Dickens, Jane Austen, the Brontes, Elizabeth Gaskell. Breathtaking, accessible science has taken us all in the company of the likes of David Attenborough to the bottoms of oceans and deep into previously unvisited wildernesses. Whole generations recall the impact on their understanding of major documentary series on TV like Kenneth Clark's Civilization and Jacob Bronowski's The Ascent of Man, and now the intellectually exacting history series written and presented by, say, Simon Sharma. Museums have become welcoming places for the general public, mounting great informative and factually scrupulous exhibitions like The First Emperor at the British Museum, with its record-breaking numbers of visitors. Such accessible experiences and possibilities have unlocked culture from the academics and the elites. So the access questions Williams raised have been transformed radically. At the same time, since the 1980s, there has been a massive increase in the 15 to 21 cohort continuing in education and in real possibilities for access to education for those who missed it the first time around. And yet, we continue to talk of the impoverishment of mass culture in the very same terms Raymond Williams cautioned us against 50 years ago. We deplore dumbing down all around us, the detrimental social effect of unscrupulous mass media, and the loss of national identity. In my second lecture, I shall argue that we are still using the wrong indicators to judge the consequences of that active engagement between cultural consumer and cultural product. Fundamentally, what matters is that the culture we consume, the masses, be emotionally rich, open and flexible, engaging us in acts of discernment which shape our emotional understanding of our lived experience. Might there, indeed, even be redemptive qualities to much maligned reality shows like Big Brother? I want to leave you with that. Sitting by a pool in the south of France this summer with the lead singer of the girl band All Saints, I could tell you how she came to be there, Melanie Blatt, but I promised I'd put her into this lecture because she was so helpful. Thinking aloud about these lectures, she explained to me that she watched Big Brother not for the production-contrived, grotesque scenarios and contests, but for, and this is really what she said, the unexpected marginal incidents produced in the course of an unscripted on-screen drama between contestants acting as themselves. From these, she maintained, she learned more about her own generation's emotional needs and responses. There was not, she explained, enough television in which she could find a place for herself. That was why she preferred the internet. In the tradition of soap opera, in which each episode must leave enough stories incomplete to tease the viewer into tuning in at the same time the following night, or let's say 40 minutes later, this is probably a good place for me to close this first Tanner lecture. In my second, I will turn to the technologies which power the culture all around us today and take a hard look at the ways in which new media, including the internet, are rapidly reshaping the context and forms of each and every individual's contemporary engagement with culture and society, reconfiguring the social process. Thank you.